will walk the earth.
The Rio Theatre is your independent East Vancouver theatre, playing first-run feature films, independent film screenings, as well as live events. Every Friday night, there are featured midnight cult classics on the big screen, and no one can beat the Rio for their cheap date Tuesdays.
Be at the Rio August 17th for Dead On Film, the zombie short film competition where 10 zombie shorts will be shown, but only one will survive. Tickets are $10, doors at 9 p.m. This month at the Rio, your Friday late night movies are Wet Hot American Summer on August 10th, Dumb and Dumber on August 24th, and Dirty Dancing on August 31st. Other attractions at the Rio for August include the world's largest touring circus sideshow, Hell's a Poppin', a sideshow review on August 19th. Extra Vancouver and the Friends of Dorothy series presents a special screening of Mean Girls on August 22nd. And don't miss Dungeons & Dragons, a live comedy experience. Join Vancouver's best comedic performers as they quest for glory and snacks on August 29th.
For more information on all this and more, check out theriotheatre.ca.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us? Just a big mistake. It's nothing more for anyone to have. Here I am, here you are. Take it slow for now.
Hi, today is Friday, August 1st. I'm Iqbal Ahmed.
August 31st. And I'm Claire Eagle. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia, to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. The current time is 5:06 and time for another full hour of independent news. Our headlines will cover local news from Metro Vancouver, provincial and federal news from across Canada, as well as news from around the world. We'll also be talking to AMS President Matt Parson for some council updates and Brian Vincent from Stop UBC Animal Research about a recent report that shows that UBC's animal research failed to meet national standards.
All this plus your weekend weather forecast right here on News 101, your source for independent news. And right now it's time for our interview with Brian Vincent from Stop UBC Animal Research. Hi, Brian. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so we know that what came out here is that Stop UBC Animal Research has said that a report released today said that UBC failed to meet national standards for its animal research. And this report was from the Canadian Council on Animal Care. So can you tell us a bit about this report?
Well, first of all, I'm not surprised because, you know, no one's really overseeing what's happening in terms of animal research at UBC. What should be noted is the Canadian Council on Animal Care is comprised mostly of animal researchers. So the report is probably very understated because you have animal researchers overseeing animal researchers, which is sort of like the fox guarding the hen house. So I wouldn't be surprised that this is just the tip of the iceberg, that there's a lot more going on at UBC in terms of deficiencies in animal care.
And so what kind of things do you expect are actually going on then? Because we know that some things that this report did call on UBC to do is have things like a better system for tracking animals or building upgrades and so on. So you're saying this is probably just the tip of the iceberg. So what are some of the more intense things that you think are probably going on?
Well, because UBC won't disclose information, I mean, you have to remember that this drips and drabs of information that UBC is leaking out as part of a orchestrated PR campaign, it's really cotton candy. It's fluff with no substance. So they're letting out information that they think, you know, will satisfy the public to a certain degree, but it doesn't tell us at all about what's really happening at UBC. For example, UBC did announce last year that nearly a quarter of a million animals were used in research in 2010 at the university. But what they didn't tell us is what species. And the reason they didn't tell us that is because they don't want the public to know that potentially UBC is experimenting on dogs or cats or primates or other animals that tend to resonate with the public. I mean, we just had, and rightfully so, outrage about the Whistler dog killing where 50 dogs were shot.
Mm-hmm.
But yet more than 200,000 animals are used every year at UBC, and there's very little disclosure about it, and therefore there's not a lot of public outrage. If the public were to find out that UBC was experimenting on dogs, we don't know because UBC won't disclose that, I'm sure the public would be concerned about that.
And so we do know that this report was made by the CCAC, and as you said, there's probably some issues because those are also university scientists and researchers from there. But do you think that this report will actually do anything in terms of getting a bit more awareness on UBC and its animal research? Or do you think that because it is just by researchers for researchers, it'll just get brushed under the rug?
It's hard to say. Is this part of an orchestrated PR campaign? That's my hunch. Remember, the Canadian Council on Animal Care has no statutory authority. It just has voluntary guidelines. So they can find all sorts of problems at UBC, but they can't compel UBC to do one thing. And UBC essentially polices itself. The fact that it, you know, it's patting itself on the back that it released this report, well, they should be compelled to release these kinds of reports every year. It shouldn't be up to the discretion of the university whether to unveil a report that shows deficiencies at the university. This should be made available to the public each and every year by law. In addition, the guidelines that the Canadian Council on Animal Care has in place should be enforceable. The CCAC or citizens should be able to file a lawsuit to compel UBC to take steps to change. So while UBC is promising to make these changes, we have no assurance that they will, and we have no way to force them to.
Right. So it seems like what this is then is kind of a potential first step that UBC could then act upon if it so chose to do so. Is that right?
You have to remember our organization has filed numerous Freedom of Information Act requests over 2 years. And during that time, UBC has not released one page of data to us. For example, we'd like to know where the primates are coming from that end up in UBC's research labs. Are they shipped from China? Are they caught from the wild? Are they from monkey farms in Thailand where there are horrific situations for those animals? We'd like to know where those animals come from. UBC refuses to tell us. We'd like to see veterinary reports and necropsy reports to determine how these animals are treated at the university. What was the cause of death? We'd like them to release photos and video footage of the experiment so the public can actually see what animal research looks like.
And I imagine probably a large part of the argument that UBC has against this is just the confidentiality of a lot of the research and so on. But certain areas, for example, where the animals are coming from, it does seem like that kind of information would be available publicly. What other kind of arguments has UBC given for not releasing this information?
Well, exactly what you said, confidentiality, competitiveness. But what they don't tell you is in the United States, where researchers are very competitive, every year, the U.S. Department of Agriculture posts online all the lab inspection reports of every publicly financed lab around the country. So you can find if a university has violated any standards. You can find out how animals are treated. Every year, the National Institutes of Health releases all the grants that they've approved, which include extensive research protocols detailing what researchers are going to do to animals, what animals they're going to use, and how many. If that system works in the United States, why is it not good enough for Canada?
It seems then that the Canadian Council on Animal Care would be the appropriate body to do that if it was given some teeth and some regulatory power. Do you see that happening anytime in the near future?
Well, the Canadian Council on Animal Care is really part of this, what I call the Bermuda Triangle of animal research, and that is you have the universities, which get public funding, you have the public funding agencies, and you have the Canadian Council on Animal Care all working together. And they don't release any information to the public. So if the CCAC finds out, for example, that UBC has violated some standards, while UBC released the report today, normally the CCAC would simply contact UBC, cite some problems there, but they can't compel UBC to do anything. All they can do is go to the funding agency and suggest, hey, you might want to withhold funding. So none of that gets out to the public. It's all this inner circle talking to one another. And there's no way that the public has a role in any of that. Mm-hmm. That's the problem with the whole system. Whether we can push through a law to change that remains to be seen, because, face it, animal research, the animal research industry, which is made up of breeders to suppliers to researchers to pharmaceutical companies, are very wealthy, and they lobby, and it's going to be very, very difficult to change the law.
All right. Well, thanks so much for chatting with us today, Brian. We definitely learned a lot. So,
hey, no problem. Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
So that was Brian Vincent from Stop UBC Animal Research. And we are going to take a quick break, but please do stay with us. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM.
CITR and Beatroot present Skills for Performing Artists through Community Engagement, or Space Camp, a free weekend of workshops and panels led by local experts in a variety of indie music-related fields. Featuring keynote speaker Ian McKay and a Saturday night rock show with Calvin Johnson, The Evaporators, New Sensei, and The Bank Dogs. Space Camp runs September 8th and 9th at Chapel Arts, 304 Dunleavy Avenue, and is open to all ages. Admission is by donation, but please register in advance at safeampspacecamp.tumblr.com.
Distance between Vancouver and Buenos Aires, 11,000 kilometers. From August 31st to September 9, the Vancouver Latin American Film Festival will bring Buenos Aires right at home. www.vlaff.org.
Hi, this is Mikhail Tank. Check out my new show, The Power of Rejection, at the Vancouver Fringe Festival this coming September. For more information, go to vancouverfringe.com and mikhailtank.com.
And welcome back to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM. I'm Claire Eagle, and I'm joined in studio right now by Matt Parson, the president of the AMS, gearing up for return to school from most of our students here. So welcome to the studio, Matt.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, so we haven't really touched base with you in a little while, but what's new in the AMS right now? What's council got for us?
So it's been a pretty transformative time for the AMS, actually. Just this past month, we've done two things that really are going to change the society for hopefully quite some time. One of them was that we revived this conference that we used to do, and it was from the early 90s to the early 2000s, which was just a conference that brought student associations, student executives from student societies together from all across the nation to talk about best practices, share ideas, and network. And it was really critical because it provided sort of the skeleton for future collaboration with student executives in the future. And we're particularly strange beasts, student societies. You're dealing with things like advocacy work, you're dealing with services, and then a lot of us also have business components to it. And then obviously the one factor that's common to all of us as well is that you have the people that are overseeing all of this being elected in on a yearly basis, and those people are students as well. So a lot to learn from each other. And that was hosted two weekends ago, and it was really exciting. We had about 55 delegates come with 21 different schools, a whole range.
That's from across Canada or across North America?
From Canada.
Okay.
It was Mount Allison, Waterloo, a lot of schools from Alberta, Saskatchewan. It was really interesting. It's nice to hear that a lot of the issues that the AMS is facing are you know, not just here local to UBC, and that a lot of students' societies also deal with similar issues, and hopefully we can learn from those individuals as well. So, some takeaways, some ideas spawned from that. Some of them are still early days, a bit too early to talk about, but one promising thing to come out of this is there's this talk of actually creating a national student survey. So one thing that we've done this year through the fantastic work of Sean Crechton and Kieran Mahal from the VP Academic Office was to create a student-administered student satisfaction survey. Which was done, and we had over 2,400 students fill it out, so an impressive turnout. And it's now arming the AMS with an incredible tool to cause a lot of change. So now when we're going to the university with what are some of the things that we want to see changed, it's not coming from a place of anecdotes and whims. It's backed in. This is what
by data points.
Exactly. Yeah. This is what the students want to see happen. And what's particularly exciting is that all the student societies really that were in attendance saw tremendous value.
So we go to weather, Claire.
Well, it is time for our weekend weather report with UBC Storm Club member Phil Chang. So, Phil, what do we have in store for the long weekend?
Hi, Kimball. Hi, Claire. Forecast is looking pretty good, actually, for this week incoming. The big question on all students' mind right now, I guess, regarding weather is how will Imagine Week turn out here on UBC campus? So to answer that, both the short-term and long-term forecast models are pretty optimistic, saying sunny on most days of the week, aside from a little bit of cloud cover on Sunday evening. So that's perfect weather for touring campus, for if you're a new student, or for members of clubs and associations to set up outside booths or organize group outings. Great. So now the weekend weather summary for the next 3 days. Tonight, we got a few clouds, low of 11. Sunday, mostly sunny, high of 21, UV index of 5. Saturday night, cloudy, low of 12. Sunday, a mix of sun and cloud, cloudy in the evening, high of 19. So that's your weekend weather summary from Environment Canada. Reporting for News 101, I'm Phil from the Storm Club. Back.
Great. Well, thanks so much, Phil. We look forward to some nice crisper fall weather coming up, but also some nice sunshine. So that'll be good, and definitely good weather for touring campus. That's pretty important in this first week, especially for Welcome Back Barbecue. We look forward to that. So now we go to your local headlines.
It's time of that year again. First day classes at UBC's Vancouver campus have been replaced with orientation activities for the majority of the more than 38,000 undergraduate students. In its 16th year, Imagine UBC taking place on Tuesday, September 4th, was created by UBC students. More than 900 volunteer student leaders will be taking part in this year. Facilities and departments across campus have organized events throughout the day to help returning students meet professors, advisors, and peers. Faculty-specific events can be found at www.events.ubc.ca. Key events include the afternoon's pep rally and a main event including a stage of performances throughout the afternoon.
More than $200,000 could be made at the BC Transit facility if commercial opportunities are allowed to flourish there. On Tuesday, Council moved ahead with zoning amendments to pave the way for the first commercial operations at the BC Transit facility in Whistler, perhaps setting the stage for more commercial operations at transit centers elsewhere in the province. The zoning change will allow transit to rent bus parking, the diesel fueling station, and the bus washing station at a fee. The $23.5 million facility is underutilized, built for 50 buses, with only 23 serving the community at the moment. The bus parking contract already secured by BC Transit will generate $40,000 per year. It deals with parking for one anchor tenant. The municipality will get $17,000 the first year, increasing to roughly $20,000 in later years. That money will go back into transit services in Whistler, as will BC Transit's cut of the money.
University of Victoria students going back to school. We had some mic difficulties. The University of Victoria students going back to school in September could face administrative headaches as support staff prepare for possible job action later this week. Members of COOP Local 951 and 917, more than 1,300 support staff who work in libraries, provide childcare, and tend to university grounds, serve strike notice on June 25th. Essential services hearing between the groups and the labor board finalizing minimal staffing levels in case of strike took place last week. A ruling is expected Monday or Tuesday, in which point the locals may follow with job action. Workers have been without contracts since March 31st, 2010, when collective bargaining agreements for hundreds of thousands of the province's public sector's workers expired. Springer says strike action will target administrative services rather than student services, and initial picket lines have occur at administrative buildings. He warns, however, that if the university does not return to bargaining table, expanded strike activities could affect students. UVic is one of four BC universities involved in strike mandates among support workers concerned about job security and wages. UBC's COOP Local 2278 tendered a monetary offer from its employer Friday after a possible strike vote in March. After a strike vote in March. While the University of Northern British Columbia passed a strike mandate in July and will begin another round of negotiations on September 27th. Support staff workers at Thompson River University are preparing for a strike vote between August 28th and September 6th.
An RCMP drug investigation that took nearly 2 years and involved authorities from Canada, the U.S., Panama, and Mexico has resulted in charges against eight people, including some top members from the Hells Angels motorcycle gang in British Columbia. The lengthy investigation, known as E-Predicate, led police to search five locations around BC over the weekend. The Hells Angels clubhouse in Kelowna was among the police targets. Officers seized an assault rifle, handguns, and nearly $4 million in cash. Mounds of that cash was on display as Superintendent Brian Cantera of the RCMP Drug Enforcement Branch in BC announced the charges to reporters on Monday. David Giles, a well-known vice president of the motorcycle gang's Kelowna chapter, was one of seven people arrested Saturday. Police say he was picked up in a Metro Vancouver casino and is now charged with conspiracy to import and traffic cocaine. Kelowna RCMP Superintendent Bill McKinnon said Saturday's arrests of some of the Hells Angels' most senior members have a huge implication for Kelowna, a city where he says eight organized crime groups have firmly entrenched themselves in the community.
Those are UBC and local headlines on News 101. And now we're going to go straight into your national headlines.
And provincial. Statistics Canada will be making the biggest revisions in 15 years to national accounts data as part of an international shift to updated standards, an official said on Friday. The changes will reflect guidelines released in 2008 by the United Nations, the International Monetary Fund, and other international bodies. The last such revision was done in 1997, based on a 1993 standard. The revised standard incorporates new weightings and measures, such as investment in intellectual property products. It should also ensure that national statistics are internationally comparable, economist James Tubrick told reporters at the federal agency. The revisions will be done first on already released data. On October 1st, the agency will provide revisions of data released this week on quarterly gross domestic product and current and capital accounts. This will cover 1981 through the second quarter of 2012. On October 12th, it will release revised productivity accounts for the business sector through the second quarter of 2012. And on October 15th, it will provide second quarter financial accounts and national balance sheet accounts, which includes household debt and debt to disposal income ratios. On those dates, there might be revisions simply because of fresher data as well as the new reporting standards. But to break said aggregate changes, such as overall economic growth, were unlikely to change much, whereas components that make up the aggregates were more likely to show adjustments.
The Canadian government said it will allow some livestock producers to defer income tax on the sale of breeding animals for 1 year, as the eastern provinces of Ontario and Quebec cope with drought, hot, dry weather this summer, drastically reducing feed supplies for some Canadian farmers, forcing them to liquidate herds. The tax deferral allows farmers to redirect money towards replenishing next year's feeding stock. Agriculture Minister Gary Ritz said on Monday. Farmers in drought-stricken areas will be allowed to defer tax on 30% of income from net sales if they have reduced their breeding herd by at least 15%. Farmers whose herds have been reduced by more than 30% can defer 90% of income from net sales.
Three more members of the Christy Clark government have announced they will not seek re-election in 2013, including high-ranking Lieutenant George Abbott, who is expected to lose his education portfolio during a cabinet shuffle next week. Abbott, who finished behind Clark and former Finance Minister Kevin Falcon during last year's leadership race, made public his intentions during a busy Thursday morning in the Clark camp. earlier, John Les of Chilliwack, the current parliamentary secretary to Clark, and Mary McNeil from Vancouver False Creek, who is a minister of Children and Family Development, also made it known that they would not seek a return to Victoria in 2013. Their decisions follow Wednesday's announcement by Kevin Falcon from Surrey Cloverdale, who resigned his finance minister post as he announced that he was bowing out due to family commitments. The loss of another big name from Clark's bench was interpreted by some as further evidence of a government in trouble. While Clark is attempting to frame the exodus as a renewal, political observers say these changes are making the Liberal Party appear more and more unstable. Clark now faces a double task of trying to name a strong cabinet from a smaller pool while also trying to find credible candidates to run in the election.
The New Democratic Party of Canada has been forced to pay back over $340,000 in ad revenue. The federal NDP collected the money from eight unions to post their logos at the several of the party's conventions over the past 6 years. Elections Canada forced the NDP to pay the money back, saying that such monetary contributions could be counted as, quote, sponsorship, unquote, not ad revenue, and accepting sponsorship funding from a union is illegal for political parties. The NDP said the money back in April and May did so quietly. It wasn't until the Toronto Star broke the story yesterday that the amounts of money involved were disclosed publicly. In her party's defense, Libby Davis said that the ad revenue sponsorship mix-up was an honest mistake and applauded the NDP for promptly paying the money back, while opposition parties are criticizing the NDP not only for breaking the rules but for failing to disclose the amount of money involved in the public.
And those were your provincial and national headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick break, but stay tuned for your international headlines.
I think the New Testament.
The question is, Pilate, you remember Pilate from the New Testament?
Pontius Pilate, he fiddled while...
Yeah, no, well, just a minute. Let me ask the question, then you can give me the answer, okay? Did Pilate want Jesus to be crucified?
Pontius Pilate washed his hands of it.
So did he want him to be crucified?
Yeah.
No. No. No.
Well, tune in every Friday afternoon, 3:30 to the Night Watch Show. What's your job?
Well, find a good church. It'll help you.
Welcome back to CITR 101.9 FM. You're listening to News 101. And next on the show, we go to Free Speech Radio News for some international headlines.
Yes, Free Speech Radio News is fantastic.
And this week, the headlines will be covering numerous topics, as they usually do, including Obama signed the executive order to combat veteran suicide, and the DOJ not bringing criminal charges in CIA inquiries.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. President Barack Obama signed an executive order today expanding outreach and prevention efforts for veteran suicide. Among other measures, veterans in crisis will be connected to a mental health worker within 24 hours, and pathways to accessing mental health professionals will be augmented, including a call to increase the number of crisis lines by 50%. The Department of Veterans Affairs is also ordered to create a national suicide prevention campaign. In addition, the order calls for the creation of an action plan to increase research on the causes, diagnosis, and treatment of post-traumatic stress disorder and traumatic brain injury. The Justice Department says it will not bring criminal charges in the case of two prisoners who died after allegedly being interrogated by the CIA. The prisoners were being held overseas by the U.S. during the George W. Bush administration. The department says that after a one-year review, the admissible evidence it uncovered, quote, would not be sufficient to obtain and sustain a conviction beyond a reasonable doubt. This investigation was the result of a larger review of U.S. interrogation practices. Justice says it was the only case where prosecutors believe further investigation was warranted. Tomorrow, workers in Seattle will begin accruing paid sick leave. It's part of a new ordinance that requires businesses with more than 4 employees to provide workers with leave for illness, family caregiving, or domestic violence situations. Some business owners oppose the law, saying the financial burden would hurt them. Joe Fougere, who owns Tutabella Pizzerias and employs 170 people, says his bottom line won't change that much and the leave will boost worker morale.
In my case, it's not even whether or not it's going to pay off. It's just whether or not it's the right thing. It's going to be about a 0.5% more of an expense to me. I'm almost embarrassed that we didn't do it sooner.
The new policy is enforced by the city's Office of Civil Rights. About 40% of Seattle workers don't currently earn paid sick leave. This number is mimicked nationwide. Many of these people are in industries like construction and travel and leisure, or work part-time. National legislation on the issue has been introduced, but has not advanced. This week, the 33rd Honduran journalist in 2 years was gunned down, and yet another campesino in the conflict-riddled Bajo Aguan region was assassinated. In another part of the country, Garofina leaders are fighting development plans for their ancestral lands. They claim to have staved off a massacre this week at the hands of powerful landowners. FSRN's Tim Russo brings us more.
Early Monday morning, nearly 300 Garifuna families organized by the Fraternal Organization of Black Hondurans traveled to Vallecito, a small tract of land on the Honduran Atlantic coast. Their mission was to recover and measure their ancestral land that was legally titled but physically denied to them in 1997. The families say that since their arrival, they have been subject to constant harassment by heavily armed private security forces that have fired weapons and surrounded their camp. Organizer Miriam Miranda says this constant paramilitary activity is connected to Honduran landowners Miguel Facuse and Reynaldo Villalobo, who have also been tied to the violence against campesinos in the Bajo Aguan.
We're tremendously worried about how the state responds. It's a clear example. They have mobilized the entire Honduran army at the request of Miguel Facuse to safeguard his African palm plantations. But in our case, it has been impossible for them to send even 4 state security officers to offer protection as we articulate and measure Garifuna communities.
According to Miranda, the complicity of the Honduran government is connected to plans for Latin America's first charter city or special development region. 24 Garifuna communities could be severely affected. The Garifuna are holding a forum tomorrow to raise awareness of the effect of charter cities on local communities. Because of self-governance provisions, organizers argue Honduras is permitting a state within a state, indicating it has no interest in protecting Garifuna or campesino land claims. Tim Russo, FSRN.
Police arrested supporters of the former president of the Maldives early this morning as hundreds protested the findings of a report by an inquiry commission. Audio from Reuters. The commission found the changeover of government in February was not a coup and that former president Mohamed Nasheed stepped aside of his own free will. The AP reports Nasheed's representative on the commission walked out because key witness statements and other evidence were excluded from the final report. The commission also found that police brutality was used against Nasheed and his supporters in the days following his ouster. And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
At the latest UN climate change talks taking place in Bangkok, Thailand, small island states are calling for immediate action to keep warming below 1.5 to 2 degrees Celsius, saying their survival depends on it. Several UN working groups met in Bangkok today to address cuts to emissions, funds to help the hardest hit countries adapt, and what's next for the Kyoto Protocol, which partially expires this year. The meeting is in preparation for negotiations in Doha, Qatar later this year. The talks come as scientists warned this week that Arctic ice cover has reached its lowest point since record-keeping began 3 decades ago. The National Snow and Ice Data Center called it an indication that sea ice cover is fundamentally changing. For more on the most recent climate talks, we're joined by Mina Rahman of the Third World Network. She's based in Malaysia and is in Bangkok now for the talks. Welcome to FSRN.
Happy to be here.
These talks are taking place just after a typhoon in South Korea. There's a drought still affecting the U.S. that could threaten global food prices into the next year. Now, tell us about the climate change concerns in Malaysia and in the Southeast Asia region.
Given the fact that we have witnessed tremendous disasters in our region, from the Philippines to Pakistan to Thailand, with floods, and now, as you mentioned, South Korea. And these events are becoming more and more frequent. So there is a huge concern now that we actually should be looking at how do we address loss and damage beyond just looking at adaptation because of these frequent weather events now. So there is a growing concern and a rising awareness that the climate talks are moving too slowly to see the kind of outcomes that really need to save the planet and the poor.
Now, Malaysia has ratified the Kyoto Protocol. One of the groups meeting in Bangkok is focusing on updating that accord. The first phase expires this year. UN-backed climate change talks have failed so far to find a legally binding agreement on reducing emissions. Where do talks stand now on the Kyoto Protocol and on what nations are discussing there?
Of course, the United States is not a party to the protocol. So the negotiations have really been held up because of the lack of movement on the part of the United States in doing comparable actions as those Kyoto Protocol parties who are supposed to do the actions. So what developing countries are strongly calling for is that before we even talk about a new climate regime, the existing legal obligations under both the Kyoto Protocol and the Convention must be respected, and there must be strong emission cuts from developed countries. Because everybody acknowledges that developed countries must take the lead. This is what the convention says. And what we see, however, happening is that there is a huge effort to actually water down the legal obligations of developed countries and shift the burden onto developing countries.
Well, this is an international conference. Many different countries are involved, but as you're pointing out, countries, especially richer countries like the United States, have been holding up parts of the negotiations. And it's worth pointing out that they're one of the largest emitters. China and the U.S. are responsible for 40% of global carbon emissions. So, what is the role of the richer nations or the more developed nations in specifically this issue of emissions and reducing emissions?
The science actually tells us that a large part of the greenhouse gas concentrations which are responsible for global warming is actually attributed to the historical emissions since the Industrial Revolution. So that's like 200 years of pollution in the atmosphere, which is how the developed countries by polluting has become wealthy and rich. We also recognize that there are poor people in the United States, and that right now that the inequality is also rising in the U.S. We in the developing world sympathize with the poor of the U.S. However, what we see is that the richest wealthy in the U.S., who are primarily responsible for much of the accumulation of wealth as well as accumulation of historical emissions in the atmosphere, they are not willing to accept that there is climate change. They're not willing to accept that the United States must show the leadership in the international community to take the kinds of emission reductions that it has to do.
Well, those cuts to emissions are a primary issue at these talks that continue next week. Mina Raman is with the Third World Network. She joined us from Bangkok, where the UN-backed climate talks are taking place. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Today, a federal judge in Ohio ruled to restore early voting across the state. The Obama administration had sued Ohio for curtailing early voting rights in certain counties with urban, heavily Democratic populations. The news comes on the final day of testimony in the trial on South Carolina's voter ID law, which focused on how the law was passed and the history of racism and voter suppression in the state. Alice Olstein has more in FSRN's second day of coverage on the trial.
On Friday, the Justice Department and intervening civil rights groups argued that the South Carolina state legislature passed a voter ID law last year with the intent of suppressing voters of color. Their expert witness was political science professor Ted Arrington. He told the court the state House of Representatives excluded African American representatives while crafting the bill, tabling all the amendments they offered to protect voters from disenfranchisement and motivating them to walk out in protest on at least one occasion. His testimony builds on evidence submitted earlier this week that civil rights groups say shows the state's discriminatory intent. The NAACP showed the judges an email from a South Carolina constituent to one of the state representatives behind the bill, arguing that a poor black person or an elderly one could easily get a voter ID. Quote, "If the legislature offered a $100 bill for getting a voter ID card, you would see how fast they got voter ID cards with their picture. It would be like a swarm of bees going after a watermelon." The state representative responded, "Amen," to the email. Leah Aiden with the NAACP Legal Defense Fund says this evidence calls into question the constitutionality of the law.
This was the lead sponsor of the bill that became the act that the governor signed into law. He responded to a racist email and affirmed it and sort of affirmed the connection between poor minority voters being impacted by this law. That was one of a number of things that go to the mentality of the legislature in passing this act.
In ruling against Texas's voter ID law Thursday, the D.C. District Court did not address the issue of discriminatory intent, but it could be a factor in the decision on South Carolina's law, which is expected before the November election.
Yeah, we hope that we'll have a good outcome in the case and that voters in South Carolina will not be subjected to this voter suppression legislation this fall when they go to vote.
That's Eric Marshall with the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, which is part of a coalition that helps voters get the IDs and information they need to cast a ballot. Working with the Election Protection Network, he helped develop a free smartphone app that assists people in registering to vote, finding directions to their polling place, learning what they need to bring to the polls, and easily reporting any problems or cases of voter intimidation. 30 states have passed and implemented voter ID bills over the last few years, and South Carolina, Texas, Wisconsin, and several other states are battling in court for the right to join that list. Marshall says the Election Protection app can help combat the effects of these laws on voter turnout.
You know, a lot of activists and people more active in reading up on this stuff are getting upset about hearing about the voter ID laws and some of the voter suppression that's going on and getting angry and saying, what can I do to fight back? Well, the smartphone app is a way for people to do something. It's got the information that voters need to know. It's also got the tools in place for people to become empowered in their community.
Such an app, though, will only reach people with access to a smartphone. And many of the elderly, low-income, and rural voters most impacted by voter ID laws, including some of the South Carolina residents who testified this week, do not have access to even a computer or a telephone, let alone a smartphone. The final testimony for the case was submitted Friday, and the court will wait to hear the closing arguments on September 24th. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
Thank you to FSRN for bringing us those headlines and news segments. More headlines and the full newscast can be found on FSRN.org.
And that's our show for today, which is Friday, August 31st. Happy long weekend to everyone. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. So if you would like to share your comments or get involved or give us an important news tip, you can contact us through our email, news@citr.ca. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews on our website, citr.ca/news. For more independent news, join us Monday and Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Claire Eagle.
And I'm Iqbal Ahmed.
Today's show was produced by Iqbal Ahmed. From the entire news team here at CITR, thank you for listening. Stay tuned for Stranded right here on CITR 101.9 FM.